This meeting of the Senate Environment and Energy Committee will come to order. We have a long list of bills, and the last one listed on the agenda, we were hoping to have a draft of it to present now. It wasn't going to be talked about until tonight, but it will be available tonight, and we'll walk through it section by section. Senate Counsel, for the ease of people figuring out what's in it, is taking items and putting them in separate articles so they can figure out this came from such and such bill and so on. So it should be much easier to see when it comes out that way. But that will not be that will be available tonight. Then we will not be acting on it tonight. We'll take testimony and everything, but we won't be acting on it till Thursday. We have some other bills on Thursday as well, but we have Thursday and Thursday evening, and if we need, and Friday as well. So I want to make sure people have plenty of chance to look over it, to amend it, to whatever. But this evening it will be available in separate articles so people can easily figure out what's in the bill. And with that, we'd like to move through these bills as quickly as we can because a number of them, some of them are ones that will be likely to be included in the omnibus bill, and some of the others have to get to other committees as well, so we want to move as fast as we can today. So with that long introduction, Senator Saxhog, welcome to the committee, Senate File 1092. And I believe you have an amendment.
I do. Mr. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have the A2 amendment.
And Senator Saxhog, while it's being introduced, why don't you explain the bill as amended?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill will remove ambiguity in Minnesota regulations regarding state-only non-federal air emission permits. The PCA has worked with Magnetation on this language, and both parties are in agreement. With me today is Mike Twitey, Environmental Director for Magnetation, to describe the bill and answer questions. I would just briefly say that for those of you that don't realize it, Magnetation is a company that recycles tailings ponds and iron ore dumps. The resulting concentrate that comes out is in excess of 60% iron, roughly the same as taconite pellets. So it's, it's the only way to put it, I guess, is recycling, and we're kind of proud of the whole situation. So I'm going to introduce Mr. Twitey.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Twitey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Michael Twite. I'm the environmental manager for Magnetation, based out of Grand Rapids, Minnesota. As the senator mentioned, we have some mineral recovery operations currently on the western end of the Mesaba Range. As we've gone through our environmental permitting processes with the Department of Natural Resources and Pollution Control Agency, we came upon an ambiguity with respect to air emission permit applicability for small operations such as ourselves. What this bill does, sir, is recommend a change in how some of the calculations are done to determine if a permit is applicable, and then it removes some ambiguity between two different pieces of the MPCA regulations.
Thank you. Senator Coonan moves the delete everything amendment to put it in the shape the author wishes. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Questions from the committee? And I should ask if the PCA is here. They've indicated, I believe, they have no concerns about the bill.
Is that that's correct, Mr. Chair. The PCA is here.
Okay.
Should there be any questions?
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Catherine Neuschler. I'm the legislative coordinator for the MPCA, and yes, I will confirm we are neutral on the bill, and I'm happy to answer questions if you have any.
Thank you. Questions from the committee. I have one, Mr. Twite, I guess for you, is that the tailings already, what percent of the waste rock, or waste tailings are iron? You say you're getting 60%. The stuff you're taking out of it is 60% iron?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Yes, sir. In general, in these tailings basins, you have iron content that varies from 18 to 35 or 40% as present in the tailings basin. And then as a result of our process, we're able to concentrate that up to 65%.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? If not, Senator Coonan moves Senate File 1092 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on State and Local Government. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you.
Senator Hur, are you ready to go?
Yes.
Is there an amendment to this?
Oh, do we have the sign-in sheet? Andrew.
Yes.
Okay, great.
Whatever you want to do, if you want to just turn it over to me, I can walk through it.
Senator Hur, it looks like you have a delete all A1 amendment in the packets.
Yes, that's correct.
Senator Hur moves the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape you like. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And this bill we're gonna lay over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, but go ahead, Senator Hur.
And Mr. Chair and community members, I'd like to pass it on to Mr. Rick Evans to walk through some of the changes.
Okay. Mr. Evans, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with XL Energy. Let me just describe generally what the bill is designed to do, and then I can answer questions as they come up. There's currently in statute a provision for what we call a gas infrastructure rider. And a rider is essentially a device that allows us, under the supervision and with the approval of the Public Utilities Commission, to recover certain costs without having to come in for a full-blown rate case. The current rider allows us to recover costs that we incur when we have to move or change underground gas facilities due to public works projects, like road projects or highway projects, that sort of thing. What's occurring now is that due to some federal regulations that have been promulgated, we are in need of going through virtually our entire gas system, doing a survey of the location of the facilities and the condition of the facilities, and repairing or replacing those facilities that are found to be wanting under these new federal regulations. These regulations arise out of some accidents that have occurred where fires and breaks in the gas pipelines have occurred, and so this is an attempt to go back in and look at all of those. And so what we're trying to do with this legislation is include in the existing rider those changes that are not required by relocation of public works, but rather are required because of the federal regulations. This is going to be an extensive project that's going to last over the course of 10 years with an investment up to $25 million a year. It's going to employ a lot of people. It's going to improve our gas delivery system and particularly the safety of our gas delivery system. But it is, because of that, a little bit out of the ordinary operation of the gas company. And so in that respect, we think it's appropriate for a rider. For rider treatment. We have worked extensively with the Department of Commerce and with the Public Utilities Commission staff to address some concerns that they raised with the original draft of the bill, and that it's those changes really that are addressed in the amendment. Most of them, I would say, are somewhat technical. The one that is substantive is in the original bill, we had provided for a process where we would go to the Minnesota Office of Pipeline Safety and get our project approved prior to it being eligible for rider treatment. And in the conversation since then with the regulators, it's been determined that that step would not be necessary. It was just adding another step to the process. And so we have removed that section. That's maybe the most substantive change that's in the DE1 amendment. I'd be happy to provide more detail or answer questions at this point.
Thank you. Questions from the committee. Mr. Evans, the PUC usually doesn't like things put in riders. They like it in the main thing, and you said they had some concerns you've been trying to address, so they'd be – I mean, they don't take positions, I suppose, on legislation, but in terms of the simplicity of the process, they'd probably prefer it the other way, but you feel you're doing it in a responsible manner here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I sure don't want to speak for the department, but yes, generally the regulators tend to like rate cases because it gives them the opportunity to look at the overall picture of the utility. But I do think that because this is sort of an extraordinary project, and we'll be talking in a few minutes about the transmission project, which I think is a somewhat similar one, we felt that this was an appropriate for rider treatment outside of a rate case. The alternative would be, by the way, because of the size of the investment year after year, we would be coming in for annual rate cases in order to recover these costs, and so this alleviates the need to do that.
Thank you. Did either Mr. Lehman or Ms. McKiernan intend to testify as well?
Only in response to questions, Mr. Okay. Chair.
Are there any questions from the committee? If not, Senator Herr moves that Senate File 1040 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevail. Senator Hoffman. Senate File. Thank you very much. Senate File 883.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for letting me be here today with you on Senate File 883. And with me today also, you're going to hear from Rick Evans and Paul Lehman as well, both from Xcel Energy, just to cover some more specifics. But there is a delete all amendment. And I will explain the differences between the two in honor of our tradition here, so that as we go on, this is about 35 seconds from now. So, but this really gets it in. That the delete all amendment, it really, because of a lot of discussion between Xcel Energy and the Department of Commerce and the Public Utilities Commission, since the bill was originally introduced, this delete all amendment addressed the issues that were raised by the DER and the PUC. So I'll explain it to you in 2 seconds. So you got it in there. If I can get a motion on the delete
Senator
all.
Senator Hoffman, you can move it, actually.
I would love to move that, Mr. Chair.
Senator Hoffman moves the delete all A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape you'd like. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The existing statute of Senate File 883, it amends the PUC's existing authority that allow utilities to recover the transmission costs that are between rate cases, and I'll explain it this way. The statute was enacted a few years ago to facilitate the expansion of the transmission grid, which you all know was needed because of the increase in customer demand and the increase in renewable energy on the system. Transmission construction projects require major capital expenditures. Do you realize that Minnesota utilities have spent $3 billion, actually over $3 billion in the last few years? And the law allows the utility to recover the costs annually through a tracker mechanism rather than filing a new rate case each year, as we heard the new rate case each year just 5 minutes ago. Stakeholders who developed the existing statute were utilities and wind energy advocates. They used the state certificate in need to determine and define the universe of facilities that could be considered for cost recovery. But the definition precluded some facilities, and this is where this bill adds it. This bill adds some of those facilities to the statute so that the PUC can consider them for the cost recovery as well. They're transmission lines that are built by a Minnesota utility, and it's used to serve Minnesota customers. However, part of the utility's interconnected system, but they're not necessarily located in Minnesota and therefore do not get a certificate of need from the state. They do have approval, though, from their own state's regulators. So as you look at this enabling bill, it really allows the PUC to consider cost recovery for these facilities. And this bill doesn't authorize automatic cost recovery, but the costs are submitted to the PUC annually for review and approval. The bill doesn't authorize recovery of costs that aren't already recoverable. It just allows a different timing for the recovery. So now, the differences between the bill that was originally set out and the one that is amended are this. If you go to the provision on line one, it clarifies the cost eligible.
Senator Hoffman, I don't think since you and the utilities and nobody's going to work, I don't think you have to explain the differences. So,
absolutely fine. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I can get some life minutes back. I'm going to lose later tonight, right? Okay. Is that? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good way of looking at it.
I love it. So you can see those differences. There's the amendment bill as stands just really adds a new category of transmission lines that the PUC could approve, and a cost recovery mechanism for. If you look at subpart 2, there's new language, and then which is gets to MISO, and then subpart 3, which is the technical changes. And then finally, Section 1, Subdivision 7, there's a new category of facilities to the cost that may be approved in the tariff. Now, remember, these lines are controlled by the federal tariff and not necessarily local. So this really gets us back to getting what's right for the customers here. And with me is Rick Evans from Xcel.
Mr. Evans, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I don't really need to add anything, I think, to the explanation that Senator Hoffman has given. This does add, as he said, to our existing transmission rider the ability to for cost recovery on lines that are located 100% outside of the state of Minnesota. And those lines are just as essential to the expansion and strengthening of the grid as the lines that are located in Minnesota. They just happen to be geographically located elsewhere. And the costs of those lines, to the extent they're allocated among utilities, but to the extent that they're allocated to Minnesota utilities, we would like to have them treated the same as other transmission costs that are included in the transmission rider. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Mr. Lehman is here to answer questions as well, but I don't think he has any additional testimony to offer unless there are questions that he has expertise on.
Are there questions from the committee? Is there a discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rose.
Just a, I should know this, but for example, on page 1, line 17, the Midwest Independent Transmission System Operator, what is that, a new change of a name, or is that just a division of MISO?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
She wants to talk about changing MISO to MITSO.
Yeah. Thank you. That's exactly. It's
117.
And yeah, on down.
Oh.
MITSO. 126. And, you can get back to us later, but I just think
it's in a lot of the bills.
We'll double check on that. That's a new one on me, Senator. But since it's added intentionally, it must be there for some reason. But we'll
a new acronym.
It's Mr. Evans. It's been in Senator Rosen. It's been in several of the bills, and I actually asked Senate Counsel. He didn't know they were changing the name, and point out we've been seeing it appear both ways. So,
okay.
As far as we know, it's the same thing with just new acronym. Senator Hoffman moves that Senate File 883 as amended be recommended pass, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Is there any discussion on that? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Coonan, thank you very much. Oops. Senator Coonan's coming right in for his bill. Senate File 1104.
We're prepared. I'm impressed.
Welcome. Do you have an amendment to 1104? Yes.
Do I have the A1 amendment, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Coonan moves the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape you'd like. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Go ahead, as you're ready.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 1104, the bill will provide a rider cost recovery for major environmental upgrade retrofit at the Big Stone Power Plant near Ortonville, Minnesota. It's just into South Dakota, about 2.5 miles. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency Regional Haze Program requires that Otter Tail Power Company and its co-owners at Big Stone Plant must reduce the plant's emission of nitrous oxides, sulfur dioxide, and particulate matter and mercury no later than 2017. The proposed advanced quality control system to be installed at the Big Stone Plant will cost between $400 and $500 million, and this will have to be recovered by the ratepayers of the three owners of the utilities. For Otter Tail, approximately $135 million of that will be from its Minnesota customers. This bill would allow Otter Tail to work closely with the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission to begin the recovery of costs when the project is begun this year. This cost recovery rider will allow Otter Tail's customers to pay as they go when construction begins, instead of waiting 3 or 4 years and then having to tolerate the rate shock that comes from loading this cost all at once. It will also provide Otter Tail Power enough assurance of having cash up front when construction begins to help in negotiating the best financing terms on behalf of their customers. And that's the bill. And, Mr. Chairman, with me I have Mr. Luckdog from Otter Tail Power Company here to do a little further description of the bill.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Luckdog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lauren Luckdog from Otter Tail Power Company in Fergus Falls. As Senator Kuhn has pointed out, the bill you have before you is a bill in support of Otter Tail's advanced quality control system at Big Stone Plant in South Dakota. The reductions in pollutants that Senator Kuhn referred to projected our sulfur dioxide reductions of 88%, nitrous oxides will be reduced by 86%, and the goal with mercury is to reduce mercury emissions by 90%. As Senator Kuhn mentioned, the projected cost for Otter Tail's customers in Minnesota is $135 million. And the technology that's being used has been developed together and agreed to with the South Dakota DNR and EPA Region 8 over the course of that time. In early 2011, Otter Tail submitted a petition for advanced determination of prudence from the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. The purpose of the petition was to seek their assurance that we're doing the most prudent thing on behalf of our customers. The commission voted 5-0 to approve our petition for an advanced determination of prudence. Over the next 4 years, Otter Tail plans to invest about $730 million in new projects. Otter Tail is only about a $1.2 billion asset utility company, so the new investment represents more than 60% of our total current assets. And that's a lot of projects to finance for in terms of the scale of the projects relative to the size of our company. And financing is a major challenge. The bill you have before you, Senate File 1104, is a modification of what was once known as the Minnesota MERP statute and more correctly today known as the Minnesota Emissions Reduction Rider. The rider that's allowed in this statute would provide a recovery mechanism for Otter Tail, allowing it to achieve, as Senator Kuhnen described, cash in the door during the first year of construction. It'll take about 3 years to do the project. If we have cash in the door, then we're able to maintain our highest credit rating with the credit agencies, and this is important for negotiating the best terms of finance with the folks who finance utility projects. This inures directly to the benefit of our customers over a long period of time. And finally, as Senator Kuhnen mentioned, we'll be able to avoid rate shock for our customers by waiting till the end of 3 years and doing it all at once. So for these reasons, Otter Tail asks the chair and the committee to include Senate File 1104, the Minnesota Emissions Reduction Rider, in the committee's omnibus energy bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Walter. Any questions from the committee? Senate Counsel points out that if you're trying to collect money over a longer period of time, you didn't know when you wanted to start, but I wonder, do you need, is August 1st okay, or do you need an earlier effective date?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we'll take as early an effective date as the chair is willing to grant us.
You're going to be collecting the money. It just depends on when you're collecting it. Mr. Fuller? No, he'd prefer it. We'll talk about that before the...
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Kuhnen moves at Senate File 1104 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Any discussion on that? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Dibble, the certs bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Eureka Recycle. That's a cool place. You ever done that? Eureka Recycle? That's where the certs, one of the certs go.
Commissioner Dibble and the CERTS team.
No, thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 1011. So, Mr. Chair and members, this is our coming annual effort now to fund the CERTS. Hopefully, we'll get it done this year because folks are familiar, of course, with the clean energy resource teams as established in state law. And since the CERTS teams have gotten up and running, they've provided a tremendous amount of value across the entire state, working with utilities, working with businesses, working with individuals and communities in a whole variety of ways to identify ways to work cooperatively, bringing on new technologies, bringing on energy efficiency techniques and programs and services and the like, assisting all the stakeholders in doing more and doing better around saving energy and around alternative sources. So, Mr. Chair, members, what this bill proposes to do is to take a portion of the assessment that we established when we modernized and updated our SIP program, and we assess annually up to $3.6 million for the purposes of doing applied research, if you will, on conservation and energy efficiency programs. And this would take $500,000 of that for that purpose. So it's not a new assessment. It's just purposing $500,000 of that. And then, Mr. Chair and members, on page 2, you'll see that we asked that a report be made by the commissioner to us about how all of that money is being used on an annual basis. That was something that I added to the bill because I noticed we don't really have a regular reporting mechanism of how this 3.6 is being used. It's great stuff that's happening, and we just should hear about it from time to time. And I have Lisa Polish and Diana McEwen, otherwise known as the CERTS ladies, here to talk a little bit more about their
Welcome
fine work.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lisa Polish, and I serve as CERT's statewide director for the University of Minnesota's Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships. My colleague and I will be tag-teaming, as we do in all of our meetings, on our testimony as well, and I'll turn it over to her.
Hi. I'm Diana McEwen. I am the Metro CERT director with Eureka Recycling. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you on Senate File 1011, which renews and continues CERTS funding. We are the CERTS ladies, or as our close friends call us, the 216C.385 ladies. The Clean Energy Resource Teams, or CERTS program, was launched in 2003 in Greater Minnesota and is designed to connect people with resources they need to identify and implement community-scale clean energy projects. The first handout you have, I know you have two, provides an overview of our work and our value. But just briefly, we work to support any community as they work to advance their own energy efficiency or renewable energy initiatives. And we do this by marshaling resources to support their on-the-ground efforts, helping them identify and draw upon other similar project models, successes, and best practices to move their efforts forward more quickly, and making sure that they benefit from others' lessons learned to avoid making the same mistakes twice. We work via 7 regional teams. You'll see the map that divides the state into 7 regions. These teams bring together people with diverse backgrounds, diverse skill sets and perspectives, yet who all find common cause in working on clean energy projects. Each team is guided by a local steering committee. You'll see the lists, so you can look in your region to see if you see some familiar names on the back of that handout. The steering committee set regional priorities. They identify emerging energy issues and opportunities. They direct seed grant funding and serve as community and technical resources in their regions.
A few of the priorities that they've identified over the past year include things on energy efficiency, solar, and biomass. On energy efficiency, this has included a lot of work and partnership with local utilities. On things like our SPLASH campaign, which is a water and thermal energy conservation campaign. On things like our family energy face-off, where we have two families competing to see who can recruit more participants to save the most energy. And on things like our Right Light Guide that now 93 utilities around the state and in Iowa have adopted as their own. We've also been working a lot on local government energy efficiency, trying to help schools, cities, and counties put more of their dollars back into their direct programming as opposed to on their energy bills. On solar, we've worked on a variety of efforts, including to identify niche applications for solar thermal hot air, hot water, and photovoltaics. We've hosted nearly 20 workshops around the state to help connect businesses and residents with tools to move their solar projects forward. And we've been working to better understand and engage with new financing mechanisms for solar, including the Wright-Hennepin co-op model, which we'll be highlighting in about a month at the Science Museum at our MetroCert event. On biomass, we've been doing research on cost-effective ways of utilizing local resources to supplement or replace delivered fuels like propane and fuel oil that many businesses and local governments around the state are still using on a regular basis. And, of course, as always, our teams continue to focus on catalyzing local economic development and spurring local project innovation. In part, we do this through our seed grant program. $70,000 of our $500,000 every year goes directly back into local projects. This past year, we funded over 27 projects statewide, including a project with Latino Economic Development Center's Business Energy Efficiency Program to help local businesses reduce their energy costs and keep more of those dollars flowing back into their business's bottom line, and with Three Rivers Community Actions Project in Northfield to spur residential energy efficiency upgrades.
In closing, we are non-policy, non-political, and non-partisan. Our approach is one of pragmatism and cooperation. We look for opportunities to bring people together to advance on-the-ground community energy projects. We provide value to the state by catalyzing projects, helping the state meet its clean energy goals, and we are really grateful for your past support and hope you will support this bill to keep our work moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you both. Senator Rosen?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the CERTS team. Just a little background on this, and Senator Dibble knows very well about this. CERTS was funded through the Renewable Development Fund for years. And when we made the changes on the RDF fund last year, we decided to have it come out of the Conservation Improvement Program, the SIP money, which seems to be more appropriate. And talk about a lobbying team. These gals are really good. My question to them, they're really good. They didn't follow me into the bathrooms, but they were close here. And my concern was that it was more geared towards the metro area, but they have been very convincing and very good about making sure that it has gone statewide. And I appreciate the language on the report, Senator Dibble, that you put onto this, too. I think that's good. And it's good for you to make sure that we are doing this statewide. It's not just a metro-rural split. And I do think you do some good work. So it wasn't a hard sell because you guys do well. I'm concerned about ongoing forever and ever, but I believe you will deliver, and that's the most important thing.
Thank you, Senator Rosen. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Dibble, I do agree. The CERTS ladies do a great job, and thank you for that. I do have a question for you, Senator Dibble, on line 2.4. It says the report must briefly describe the activities. I'm wondering if you'd be open to changing the word briefly. Part of sometimes my frustration in reading the reports is the descriptions are so brief, I don't have any better idea of what was done after I read it than prior to, and they do such a good job that I would like to have a fairly clear idea from the report of what they've done, and I don't know if council could help with that, if you're open to some sort of a language change to give a little more description than just briefly. But
Senator Dibble, we could put long-winded.
Yeah. I'd like something in the middle.
Maybe we could just strike the word briefly if so.
Briefly or replace it with the word clearly.
or that's good, or thoroughly. Or.
I think that if we they've got the message that they want more than a brief response. So, Senator Dibble, would you like to strike the word briefly? You want to replace it or just leave it or
strike it? I appreciate Senator Brown's comment. I agree with it. And the danger of just simply striking the word briefly is.
But we'll clearly, perhaps you're suggesting.
Clearly or thoroughly? Senator Brown, do you have a preference? Clearly, thoroughly?
Clearly. I like clearly.
Clearly? Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I'll move that we describe, that we remove the word briefly, strike the word briefly on line 2.4 and replace it with clearly.
On that motion, is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Another question. This is going to finance, I believe. Okay, I had a question about the fiscal year versus calendar year question, but is there further discussion on this? I would encourage you to share with maybe all the members of the committee have already seen them, but some of the things that some of the utilities have picked up from your flyers and reprinted to share with their customers, because I think it is very efficient where somebody's, where you're picking out creative things that help people conserve water or energy and so on, and you're, and they're distributing to their customers in their monthly bills. It's, I think it's a very effective way to get your message out to a lot of people. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I did bring up another conversation that we had about how they were supposed to make sure not only take it statewide, but engage partners in this. And that's, they've clearly been able to demonstrate that, that it is a partnership. And to make them accountable going forward. So,
and further discussion. If not, Senator Dibble moves that Senate File 1011 be recommended, passed, and referred to the Committee on Finance.
As amended.
As amended. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
You want me to just stay put, Mr.
You
Chair?
You might as well,
all right.
Senator Dibble. Senate File 1135.
All right. Thank you. So, Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment to offer. It's the A1.
Senator Dibble moves the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape he'd like. Is there any discussion? Oops, does everybody have the amendment? It's in the packets, I guess.
Yep.
Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 1135 is really just a bill that doesn't make dramatic changes, and I want to emphasize that at the outset because there's one thing that might get people's attention, and it's really not a big change. But what it does, Mr. Chair and members, is to really establish a strong and clear policy statement. It kind of builds on the significant policy work we did a few years ago around energy conservation and efficiency, recognizing that we've made tremendous progress these last number of years, mostly in utility-driven efforts to achieve a high level of energy savings. There's additional interest in finding other means and methods of finding energy savings, and much of that work is going to occur outside of utility-driven efforts. Some of this, of course, at some point along the way, if research and efforts and external efforts are successful, may well be taken up by utilities, but that remains to be seen. So we add to our some language to our policy saving goals. In the first section, you can read that for yourself, and take a look at some sort of efforts that we can undertake as a state. And, of course, we know about the Sustainable Building 2030 work that's going on at the University of Minnesota, for example, to create a tremendous amount of research and a higher standard for energy building goals. That's one great example. Creates some additional policy language around state-driven energy planning and the purposes for our planning around energy efficiency and research. That's in the next section. in restating that our energy saving goals are 1.5%. And then we take a look at we have the amended language. We take a look we ask that we take a look at some of those methods and techniques to maximize long-term cost energy savings, to minimize waste. Of course, we had that discussion a few days ago with district energy, carbon reductions, increasing efficiency in all sectors, minimizing utility costs and rate impacts. That's the cost benefit, the cost effectiveness that all should drive all energy efficiency efforts that we have, what appropriate funding sources are. Again, we touch on cogen, combined heat and power, et cetera, and look at whether or not the IRP, the Certificate of Need processes, have any application. With that, Mr. Chair, I have Sheldon Strom from the Center for Energy and the Environment who can share some more thoughts about this proposal.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Sheldon Strom. I'm director of the Center for Energy and Environment. There's a handout that was handed out that gives you a quick summary of the bill. But as Senator Dibble said, this builds on the success of the utility programs that we passed in 2007. I think Minnesota Utilities has been doing a good job. The savings from that Minnesota Utilities have achieved, for example, in 2011, were just about as high as any state in the country. And that's particularly impressive because we have lower rates than most states. So our utilities have done a good job. I think to date, Minnesota's focused mostly on what utilities could do, and there may be other opportunities beyond what utilities are doing, as Senator Dibble mentioned, to get additional savings. So what this bill does, in addition to clarifying some goals, and I want to mention one thing about the state's goal of at least 1.5%. I want to differentiate that currently the state has a goal of 1.5% and utilities have a goal of 1.5%. And utilities, most of the major utilities are achieving the 1.5% goal. Clearly, the state is achieving a higher level than the 1.5 if you add in the other things that they're doing with codes and standards and customers that have opted out of SIP and so on. So this language simply recognizes that we're achieving at least 1.5% from the state standpoint, not the utility standpoint. This doesn't change the utility goals at all. It doesn't change the provisions utilities currently have to meet that 1.5% goal by first meeting 1% directly with energy efficiency, an additional 0.5% through other strategies that may include supply side or infrastructure improvements. It also doesn't change the fact that there are provisions for municipal utilities and co-ops that if they have low avoided costs or don't have these opportunities for savings, they can petition the department for a lower savings goal. So it doesn't really change any of those things. What it does primarily is establishes a process to take a fresh look at all of these goals, specifically looking at our energy savings goals. Can we achieve higher goals than we're currently achieving for the state and for the utilities? Should those goals be different for municipal utilities and co-ops and investor-owned utilities? Should we emphasize annual goals that lead long-term savings as opposed to just, right now we have an annual goal, so if you implement short-term measures, you achieve that goal. Obviously, it's a lot better that you implement a 25-year measure life and achieve that goal. So that's why we're saying we want to move towards long-term energy savings. If you do that, it has the effect of maximizing carbon reductions, and it does that by creating great economic benefits because efficiency is so cost-effective. Also, there's a provision that we would ensure that this minimizes total utility costs, and as Senator Dibble said, by definition, cost-effective energy efficiency does that. So utility ratepayers as a group will save hundreds of millions of dollars through energy efficiency every year. There also is a impact on non-participating ratepayers, and we're saying we want to minimize the impact on ratepayers who aren't participating in these conservation programs. But obviously, those that participate get great benefits. And then there's also been a lot of discussion about items that may be related to efficiency or may not, and that includes combined heat and power and cogeneration projects, certain renewable projects, and we're simply suggesting that over the interim between the legislative sessions that the Department of Energy Resources convene a series of meetings about these issues, kind of vet all these things so that next year we could come back to the legislature with a more informed recommendation about what to do all with all of these different strategies. And another thing that's on the list is to look at how this impacts resource planning and the certificate of need. One of the great things about efficiency is it can avoid the need for new power plants, but it makes a difference whether you are a growing utility and you need to add more capacity. In that context, energy efficiency is probably a lot more important than for a utility that's not growing as much. So all this does is outline the types of issues that would be addressed with no particular bias as to how they'd be examined. And the idea is that we have a thoughtful discussion over the summer and before the next legislative session so people could come in with more informed suggestions or modifications for next year.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. And I hope, since I'm sure you'll be involved with DER in this discussion, that they bring open some of the areas that have seldom been touched, like such as rental property stuff where landlords could be somehow or another working with utilities and their renters to make more efficient appliances, and so areas that haven't been touched much, I think, and huge potential, I know.
Senator Marty, members, and certainly I think the idea here is that we've had a lot of experience. Now's a chance to kind of take a fresh look at what are we doing well, what are we missing, how can we improve things. That's really the point of this.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Cindy Jepson, and I'm representing Evergreen Energy. We worked on this amended language in conjunction with CEE, and the bill as amended is something that Evergreen does support. We think that taking a new fresh look at this during the interim might launch us into some positive strategies going forward next session.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dibble and Mr. Strom, I do have some concerns about some of the language in this bill, specifically on page 1, lines 9 and 10, where it talks about energy savings should be procured systematically and aggressively, and then moving down to line 14, where we're I'm kind of reading into it that we're in the process of raising the standard of 1.5%. Could you address what your goals are with this legislation, especially, Mr. Strom, since you talked about coming back next year to discuss some of those goals? Is it the goal of this legislation to raise that 1.5% standard over the long term? And the second question, lines 16 and 17 on page 1, how are these energy savings going to be measured?
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brown.
Senator Brown, sorry.
What we're trying to do here is to see what is the maximum cost-effective savings we can achieve. So we're trying to see if we can achieve more, but we want to do that in a cost-effective and practical way. And that's what we've been able to do so far. Our utilities have been able to achieve these savings and save large amounts of money at the same time. So what we're trying to do is see how much can we save and still be cost-effective. And in particular, this at least 1.5% requirement for the state recognizes, as I mentioned, that in addition to what utilities save, there's a lot more that can be done by non-utility actors. The question of how you measure that is an interesting and somewhat difficult one. For example, for appliance efficiency standards, there's actually good information for Minnesota about how much energy has been saved by appliance efficiency standards in Minnesota. Those savings used to be savings utilities achieved, but as these standards became into play, The state still got those standards, but they were mandated mostly by the federal government. And so those savings weren't accounted for utilities, but they were still counted for the state. So that's fairly easy to measure and readily available. Some of these other issues are more difficult to measure and would require some work on the Department of Energy Resources part to better estimate that. I don't think we'll get the precision in measuring those savings that we do with direct utility programs, but I think it's an important issue to look at, because what we really care about in Minnesota is cost-effective energy savings, regardless of where they occur. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Strom, well, I guess I'm interpreting your response that you do want to raise the 1.5%. Is that an accurate interpretation?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
If I could ask Senator Brown to be a little more precise. The 1.5% goal for the utility SIP programs, because that's a different thing.
For the annual retail energy sales of electricity and natural gas.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, if you're speaking about the 1.5% annual retail sales required under the conservation improvement programs that utilities are asked to achieve, the 1%, then the 0.5%, the answer to that is no. This is more speaking
overall
larger
state not the utility programs.
Right.
Further questions? Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Dibble, I don't remember seeing a bill with findings in it before. So if you could help me understand, when the legislature finds something, does that have an impact? Can you explain the impact that has on policy, or is it just there as a nice, warm, fuzzy thought? I don't understand what this accomplishes.
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, It provides guidance, to the Department of Energy Resources, to ourselves, et cetera. Establishes a statement of policy. This is adding to existing findings and amending existing findings. Findings are, I concede, not common, but they're a little more. We find them a little more commonly in some of our energy policy, because sometimes we're communicating to utilities, sometimes we're communicating to the commission, sometimes to the agency, kind of establishing, because we defer so much detail to the commission, for example, or to the agency or to the utilities, that sometimes they are looking to the legislature and they take policy guidance very seriously.
Further discussion. Senator Dibble moves. Oops.
No, I was just going to ask Mr. Chair, and this is not a vote I would ever win, but we do have the provision in the findings that emissions cause climate change, and I can understand the goal of reducing pollutions and emissions, but we are therefore finding as a state legislature that there is a cause for climate change, that the emissions cause climate change, and that is going to be a matter of some controversy and some discussion, but as I said, Mr. Chair, I'm not going to move to delete it because my guess is I would lose amazingly badly in this committee. So I just want us to be aware that when we pass this bill, we're making a pretty serious statement, which was your goal.
Senator Dibble moves Senate File 1135 as amended be recommended to pass. Is there further discussion on that motion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Senator Dibble, one more.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
This is on the PACE program?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Then Hinkle is here to help me. So, Mr. Chair, remember, this is 1121, Senate File 1121. And Mr. Chair, a few years ago we established the Property Assessed Clean Energy Program. I think folks are pretty familiar with it, and it's been through some.
Thank you.
It was kind of took the country by storm a few years ago, and greeted with a great deal of enthusiasm, and kind of fell down in the residential application, but the commercial application actually is quite viable. It fell down because complicated financing rules around financing residential property, Fannie Mae rules and subordination of positions, et cetera. But it works pretty well in the commercial sector. And this is the opportunity for folks to finance energy efficiency and other kinds of energy improvements to their buildings, work with local municipalities for that financing, and have those have that financing paid off over a period of years and assessed to their property. However, there was a little glitch, and so this is a fix to the glitch in our own rules around assessment law rules, which limits those sorts of special assessments to 10 years. This allows the payback to be made over 20 years. We tighten up the definition of what a cost-effective energy improvement is. And then if you look in Section 4, we extend the ability to pay back these sorts of improvements through the property tax mechanism from 10 to 20 years. And Lynn Hinkle, who didn't actually bring me this bill came over from a colleague in the House, but Lynn Hinkle works closely with these PACE programs and can help us understand this proposal a little better.
Mr. Hinkle, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lynn Hinkle. I'm policy director for the Minnesota Solar Energy Industry Association. And I'm here to speak in strong support of Senator Dibble's bill. Let me add to the point that Senator Dibble made at the conclusion of his remarks. This clearly is a technical fix. When we passed the PACE legislation, the enabling legislation in 2010, we had the interconnect language connecting the 20-year revenue bond payment term from 116C 436 in the special assessment statute of 429-101. And vice versa, we had a linkage from 429-101, the special assessment statutes, back into the provisions for financing in 116C 436. What we did not do was to delete the 10-year equal payment language that was contained in the special assessment language, which in effect provided a constraint on the 20-year terms that were codified in the PACE language. That's had the effect of slowing down and reducing the size of projects, both for energy efficiency and renewables going forward. And this bill, with this fix, provides us an opportunity to move forward and realize the full impact and the full benefits of this new, really transformative financial instrument. When this bill was passed in 2010, many members in this room will recall that there was broad bipartisan support, and that bill was passed into the governor's jobs bill early in the session as a result of that overwhelming support. And that same bipartisan support is reflected at the federal level. Currently, there's a bill moving through Congress, and as of this morning, there were slightly fewer Republicans who had signed on, slightly more Republicans who had signed on to co-author that bill than Democrats. So this is the kind of bill that we're happy to be supporting, and we're aware that it receives an enormous amount of bipartisan support because it's essentially a private market mechanism. It's mobilizing private finance dollars to do work on private buildings with private contractors. There's minimal involvement from the public sector, and all of the costs, if there are, that are borne by a public entity, get rolled into the financing cost and are financed, as I indicated a moment ago, through private revenue bonds. Let me conclude by making myself available for any level of detailed question that you might have about PACE or how this is working in different cities in the state already, most notably in Edina. But I'd like to highlight three things. I characterized this earlier as a transformational finance instrument, and it is that because it does three things. Number one, the financing, because it's an assessment, moves with the property so that financing is transferable at point of sale, and this overcomes the constraint that we call the short hold constraint that many commercial owners live with, assuming that they wouldn't be able to do long-term financing, that at point of sale the financing issues would have to be resolved. This removes that difficulty, makes it totally transferable, and opens up that horizon for longer-term financing, deeper retrofits, greater impact on local economies, and clearly a lot more jobs. The second thing it does is it facilitates savings-only repayment. And this is critical for a business, whether it's commercial or industrial, because it prevents the use of internal capital. This is savings-only financing, so we're not using capital that's being used for core business purposes. And the third thing is that this is off-balance sheet. Any one of those things would be sufficient to put this in the category of not just innovative but transformational. All three of those things make this a program that, with these fixes, can be utilized to do the kind of longer-term, deeper retrofits and have the maximum impact that it should in our state. With that, stand for questions.
Mr. Hinkle, is the reason the commercial PACE is going better is that they're already allowed a 20-year payback? Or they're doing the financing of that not through assessment, they're doing the financing of that through without that process?
Mr. Chair, good question. The reason that commercial industrial has remained a viable category for PACE financing is that the covenants that govern the financing in the commercial industrial sector dictate that if there's any other lien that is put on the property as a result of an assessment or other category, that has to receive the consent of the mortgage lender. And that's what's going on now, is that these processes, these programs, don't move forward without gaining the explicit consent of the mortgage lender to have a lien, which is what the special assessment represents, in a senior position.
Thank you. Questions from the committee. Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Senator Dibble, on page 2, lines 9 and 10, could you provide more clarity as far as the insert of that language, maybe examples or what, provide a little bit more clarity of where you're going with that?
So, Mr. Chair and members, I think this has to do with the this comes out of the some of the cost some of the requirements around some of the SIP programs, and maybe Mr. Fuller can help me. This has to do with some of the financing programs that we have available and how we evaluate how we conduct the audits, evaluate cost effectiveness, et cetera. I'm not exactly sure why we have to insert the language that says not prohibit the financing of all cost effective energy improvements not otherwise prohibited.
Mr. Fuller?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Osmond, I'm not crystal clear on this either, but if you go up to line 2.1, it's talking about the financing program that's going to be in the local government. And I assume the concern was that they don't want a program to say, if you do this, you can't do that, and just rule something else out. But I don't know who objected, who brought that forward, so I don't know the context. That's what it says, that Edina can't say, if you get some money from us, the only way you can get is if you don't put new windows on through First National Bank.
Senator Husman?
Oh, it's clear as mud. Thank you.
I'd say about the same. Senator Benson and Senator Wiggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And perhaps Mr. Hinkle, talking about the mortgagors, FHA, the banks, where are they at on this right now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, there's a lengthy rulemaking process that's underway right now with FHFA at the federal level. That rulemaking process is scheduled to end sometime the beginning of the summer, and there's been considerable stakeholder input from the finance industry at all levels, most notably the mortgage lender segment. And there's been developed some pretty strong language in response to their stakeholder input that improves, in their view, and has already been incorporated as language in the federal bill for enhanced underwriting. Their issue is that they want to make sure that there's adequate underwriting protection to make sure that the mortgage is paid, that the asset value of the property is enhanced, all of which we've maintained. But in the process of reviewing the stakeholder comments from the mortgage lender industry, thanks, much of that language has been incorporated.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Hinkle, so these liens, I'm sorry, the mortgages would be subordinate to the liens. Is that accurate? And the way they're going to get at that is through changing the underwriting process?
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, if I understand your question, yes, that the enhanced underwriting, for example, that there needs to be a savings to investment ratio of greater than one, so that you're essentially setting up a positive cash flow for that business, and thereby, clearly, from the standpoint of the mortgage lender, providing greater assurance that they're going to be able to handle the mortgage payments.
Okay, and so, Mr. Chair, what that sounds like to me is if we're getting into underwriting, we're actually making it a little more difficult to get some of these mortgages if one of these liens is attached to the property. And so please explain to me how is this working in Edina? Are we moving into a new regulatory environment? Do we have enough experience to not and I know this isn't a huge project, but we don't want to dampen the market already through unnecessarily complicating things. And so if you could help me.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, thank you for that question. The experience that we've seen in jurisdictions in other parts of the country, Sonoma, Boulder, there's a program on Long Island, would indicate that, in fact, the mortgage lending industry is moving towards embracing this because of what I just indicated, that it improves the mortgagees, the mortgagors' ability to pay. It increases the asset value of the property at sale, that there are fairly significant financial benefits that accrue to a mortgage lender, but they have to have in place some of the enhancements to the underwriting that I spoke of a minute ago. So I guess what I would say is that while initially there was some concern about how this financing product would work in the market, what we're beginning to see is the mortgage lending industry and other banks moving into a position where this is becoming a customer offering, that it actually is a product that the banking industry is moving towards using itself because they see the benefits are multiple.
Senator Weber, then Senator Osmick, I believe, again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not having been here a couple of years ago, just a quick question as it relates to, having been in local government, obviously the assessment process is generally designed for public improvements and that the government is in effect, forcing upon the property owner. In this particular scenario, if a property owner chooses to have this done, does this require the local unit of government that they have to provide that option, or do they have the option of saying, no, we're not proceeding down that road?
Mr. Chair, Senator Weber, great question. One of the delightful parts of our bill is that it's a voluntary program. It's voluntary. The property owner voluntarily seeks or petitions for the special assessment. The city is not forced to participate. If it wants to enable this, it's certainly in a position to do that and drive some of these projects and reap the economic benefits at the multiple levels. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, we've gotten a lot of support from cities around the state who are kind of looking at this and saying, we hope this moves forward because it'll open up the door for us being able to help facilitate more of these projects. And I know I'm going to leave off the list a number of cities, but we've been in consultation and discussions with folks in Worthington, Northfield, Maplewood, Maple Grove, Minneapolis. Region 5 is very interested in pursuing this as a financial development tool. So it's a program that we're hoping will be able to make these modest technical fixes to and generate a lot of beneficial economic activity.
Senator Osmick, did you have a follow-up?
Just to Mr. Chair, just a procedural question. Where's the destination after this committee with this?
This bill, we were wondering if, because it dealt with assessments, if tax committee was, but they haven't asked for it.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Benson. To that point, we've heard some local gov, and there's some banking things that would be impacted through the mortgage industry. So I just want to be thoughtful about where we send this next.
Staff checked with local government. They did not feel a need for this. This is not specific to anyone. This is a program that's already been there. They're just changing. It hasn't been used, apparently, because of the 10-year versus 20-year financing. Senator Brown.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that extent, are we looking at possible inclusion in an omnibus bill?
Senator Brown, I'm interested in this provision, yes.
Okay.
I'm happy to let it go. I don't know whether it was going on its own in the House or not, but I had it here that this was going on. So, Senator Dibble, you have, do you know, is this, you met House deadline? Is this
yes, Mr. Chair, it has met House deadline.
We can move it. It may appear in the omnibus bill as well.
Yeah, and I don't know what my counterpart in the House intends for it, but if we could sail it, dual track it.
Senator Dibble, further discussion? If not, Senator Dibble moves Senate File 1121. Did we amend this?
No.
Senate File 1121 be recommended to pass. On that motion, any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Bonhoff. If there's anyone here for either of Senator Schmidt's bills, I believe we're taking them both up tonight. So I just want to make sure, just heard that those will not be up till tonight. So we're going to cut off after the next three bills. Senator Bonhoff.
Mr. Chair, members, you have really moved quickly. Thank you very much. I'm here on Senate File number 248, and I have a delete all.
Is it in the packets? It's being distributed. Why don't you start discussing what you're trying to do while it's being distributed?
Very good. And the delete all, the reason we're doing that is because that is the version that passed in the House and went to the floor, and it has been worked out with the DNR, and so that was language that we agreed upon. We're dealing with a very small body of water in the city of Woodland, which is a very small city right next to Minnetonka and Deephaven, in the middle of those two areas. And rather than me tell you about this small lake, I have Peter Davis with me who will do that. But I just will tell you that this is a lake that has a great amount of love and commitment from all those who live around it. And so they have taken it upon themselves to do everything they can and are now here asking for some regulatory help to move that process forward.
Senator, before that, Senator Coonan moves the A2.
Mr. Chair, I was going to move it.
Oh, Senator Rosen moves the
A2. I'm a co-author on it. So the A2 amendment, please.
Senator Rosen moves the A2 amendment. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I appreciate your taking a few minutes. We prepared a briefing package for you. And I think as you'll become familiar, you'll understand that our plight as a lake is not unique anywhere in the state of Minnesota. Maybe some of our circumstances are. But our plight is the fact that we've got this hard bottom lake. It has anywhere between 22 to 15 acres of water. The water level goes up and down like a yo-yo. But what is unique about us, and if you turn just in the interest of time to page 4, I can cite all sorts of statistics about the lake. The picture on the top left corner of page 4 shows you what the lake had reduced itself to back in the early 80s. In other words, our plight is not unique. We're arguing that the cattail, which has gone hybrid, and the narrowleaf cattail is an invasive species. We know because in 1983, the DNR granted us a permit for the entire lake to remove all these cattails, and they all came back. And if you look on the right side of page 4, that's what the lake looked like after we did this massive restoration project before I moved to the lake. By the way, I represent not only been a homeowner for 15 years, but I'm also the president of the Shavers Lake Preservation Association. And as Senator Bonhoff said, we're very active trying to maintain the lake as best we can as great stewards, not only for the homeowners' uses, but all the ecosystems and wildlife and fish that use this lake as well. If you flip to page 5, you can see that between the early 80s, we did this cleanup project, but by 2011, and the picture in the top right is actually a picture of where our shoreline is. I'm the rink master in the winter months as well, and our nice little skating rink and hockey rink started tucked in up on the shoreline when I first moved to the lake and is now practically out in the middle because of the cattail growth. So this is already happening again, and if we don't get some help, we're going to have these cattails take over the lake because we're in a low water year, and as a consequence, all of this biomass that keeps building up and decomposing is now caused a sediment buildup. And I will tell you, the cattails are not the only problem we have. They're just one of the many symptoms we have, unfiltered water, submerged weeds. But if we don't control the cattails, the lake will become a cattail marsh. And that's our challenge. So on page 6, you can see what it looked like, what it's becoming already. We're very afraid because we've seen an acceleration in the growth of the cattails in the last few years as the water levels have been going down. And as I said, we're planning for a low water series of years, and our fear is that we're just going to lose the lake if we don't take more aggressive action. So in summary, we've got a really special lake that a lot of wildlife depends on. We love it. It's impaired from a recreational standpoint. If we don't get rid of these cattails, we'll lose the lake forever. And that's what we're asking for your support on. I'd be very happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Davis. Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Davis, what would you use to get rid of the cattails?
Our plan would be no different than we did back in the early 80s. Which is in the winter months, you shave them down to the ice, you flood them with water in the lake, and then after you get the biomass out in the spring through any number of mechanical means. So it's a strictly a mechanical process to control them. We can do harvesting, but that has not proven to be as effective for us.
Shaver's Lake, you shave them off.
Very good, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Davis.
Senator Weber and Senator Rosen.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I assume this is a cost that's borne by the Lake Association, correct, sir?
Yes, yes. We're actually a privately owned lake, even though we're a public water.
Sure. Very good.
Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, that was my question. And if There's no further questions. I would like to move Senate File 248 as sent to the floor or in the omnibus bill.
This goes to state and local.
Mr. Chair, I have a question about that because it did go right to the floor in the House committee. What about the bill takes it to state and local?
It can go to the floor right away.
Senate, Mr. Knopf says it can go to the floor. I do have a quick question, though, before that. Is anybody from DNR here who wishes to speak to this? Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Dirk Peterson. I'm the Chief of Fisheries for the DNR. We oversee the Aquatic Plant Management Program. And we have reviewed this situation, and we understand Mr. Shaver's Lake, and we're prepared to issue a permit that will address the concerns that he has. We're supportive of the bill.
Thank you very much. Senator Dibble, then Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, I'm caught up in the same conversation with Loring Pond in the middle of Loring Park. So I'm tempted to amend this, but I'm not going to.
Thank you, Senator Dibble.
DNR has been resistant, even though the cattails are completely taking over Loring Pond. And the Loring community had put a ton of money into restoration, doing some native aquatic plant installation. And now it's actually invasive cattails it's not the native cattails that have obliterated all of that investment and are actually presenting a bit of a public safety issue because, you know, they screen people, so can't see what's going on, and it's dangerous. And I don't know, DNR has been difficult to work with on this subject. So I'll just put that out there, and I'm going to solve this problem in Loring Pond.
Sarah Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I was going to ask a question similar along those lines. Having had a property on Lake Benton once upon a time, which had a curly leaf pondweed issue, and that there was an extensive effort made to bring that under control, and they finally got to it after we had left the lake. But and I don't know whether there was actually legislative action required in order to do that, to be honest with you. Is there a process, not obviously for Senator Bonhoff's bill, but a process whereby, rather than making everyone come in front of the legislature, that there can be a process by which this is handled somewhat more efficiently?
Go ahead,
Mr. Chair, Senator. We do what we call a lake vegetation management plan, and it's a vehicle that we'll use to work with the Shavers Lake Association, where we comprehensively take a look at the lake, the aquatic plant community, discuss with the people that are directly affected, and come up with a plan that allows reasonable access, some open water areas for recreational use, can also provide for invasives control.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonner.
Mr. Chair, members, Senator Dibble, if you look at the original bill, Senate File Number 248 was a much broader bill that did allow for exactly what you're looking for. DNR did not support that, and so the bill as drafted did garner support, and that's why I went that way. But I leave that with you to to pursue at your own discretion.
Senator Bonhoff's hoping her bill doesn't grow too fast. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I believe Citizens for Loring Park Community had done this, and then that gave rise to all these investments they made in installing native aquatic plant species. Went to several thousand dollars that this study costs, all to be obliterated by these invasive cattails that now they can't get a permit to eradicate. So now they have to go to another several thousand dollar study process and develop a new plan, et cetera, et cetera. Just want to cut off those cattails and get rid of them. That's all we want to do.
I think this is something we may want to take another look at, too, with other lakes. So, Senator Osmond.
And I would echo the sentiment here,
which is that, too.
There's a problem there, too, is that on Lake Minnetonka, we have the same sort of situation, and I actually sort of liked the original version because that lake could use some help, too, in certain areas to go through permitting, so I'd like to see this come back for more global or even do the original bill, frankly.
I think there are a number of members of the committee that might want to talk with each other because I think there's a lot of people have interest. Senator Rosen, you were moving the bill, I assume.
I was, Mr. Chair. I think let's just get this moved out and then we can work on something else.
So
I moved that Senate file 248 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
Elm Creek? On Senator Rosen's motion to be recommended to pass and as amended and referred to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much.
So,
Senator
Mr.
Thomas,
Chair.
Senator Scalzi.
What would be the process then? Because this is hanging out here, and we don't want to just drop the ball. I mean, I signed on to the original bill as a co-author. I would not have signed on to it had it been amended at the time because I don't like to do individual lake stuff. We've heard of like three or four instances just at this table. This is something that we should just pass the bill as unamended. I mean, in my estimation, I don't know why we wouldn't, because we're going to forget about it. And if this applies, if this is a good deal for one lake, as the DNR has stated, then it should be a good deal for all lakes.
I have a suggestion.
Senator Dibble.
Maybe we can reconsider our motion. Well, I don't want to ruin Senator Bonoff's.
Nor do I. I think.
Yeah.
I'm wondering. One option could be we could have the committee convene, ask DNR to meet with a number of us and sit down and talk about this. I'm open to whatever approach you want to take, but that's one option we could do if you're interested.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Scalzi can certainly take her name off, but I do think this merits some attention by the other people that have concerns. But it would not be fair to hold a Senator Bonoff's bill that it's 248. She's been working on this since the beginning of session. So,
well,
Senator Dibble,
my suggestion was not to hold up Senator Bonoff's language, but was to reopen the bill, add Senator Bonoff's language to 248, or add this language back to 248, get it to the floor at least.
Mr. Chair, I have an idea.
The original bill had to go to state.
Yeah, the original bill did have to go to state and local, but that doesn't mean that there's not time for it, but the DNR, I'm sure, will want to comment more on it.
Not that I'd like to hijack anything, however, we are going to be listening to the miscellaneous provisions for DNR for Senator Schmidt. That certainly could be something could be amended onto there or put into the omnibus.
Senator Bonoff, you're welcome to come back to the table, and maybe the DNR could as well, just to comment on the discussion.
And Mr. Chair, what I was going to suggest is similar to what Senator Osmak said, that you could certainly take that language and, as an amendment, put it into your omnibus bill or anything else. And so I appreciate the dual track. We can let the motion stand as passed, and then if I, leave it to the will of the committee, which I strongly encourage you to do, amend the broader language onto something.
Okay. Mr. Peterson?
Chairman, if I could speak to the broader issue, I believe the original bill speaks to removal of cattails with no permit, and cattails are a critical natural component of most of our lakes, and they provide a broad function of providing erosion control on our water bodies around the state. And the issue of narrow leaf or hybrid cattails is one that, although there's some debate as to whether they're invasive or not, and so that's not fully resolved yet, but they look similar to native cattails, and if there were no permit required, then there would be probably lot after lot on any given lake where that shoreline erosion function that cattails provide, as well as being a nutrient sink for sediment and other nutrients that come into the lake, there's a number of beneficial aspects of having emergent vegetation along a shoreline. So what we try and do is work with property owners to get reasonable access to open water, to provide swimming areas or boat docks, and still maintain all the beneficial values that cattails have on our waterways and our lakes. So to remove the permit requirement or the ability to develop a lake vegetation management plan with a broader group like the Shavers Lake Association could have some broad impacts on Minnesota's lakes.
Mr. Peterson, I understand that. I also sense that there are a lot of folks who feel DNR is not responsive enough to trying to do it. I understand the concerns, but what would you recommend for the other, I've heard, four or five lakes being mentioned? And it looks like Mr. Davis is willing to speak to this briefly as well. Why don't you give your comment first and then ask DNR?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I have to apologize to Senator Dibble because actually lowering pond was actually going to be my another example I was going to use where the cattails have just taken over. This is a very challenging issue, and not that this committee hasn't taken on a lot of challenging issues already in this session, but the fact is we're trying to go nutrient negative as a lake. Now, when does the DNR talk about going nutrient negative? What they talk about is how to keep nutrients from coming in the lake, and they use the cattail as one of those buffer zone type plants. That's a bigger and a more challenging topic to deal with, and I appreciate the fact that opening up this bill would actually expose a lot of the issues regarding buffer zones and the like, which are, in fact, a technique that the DNR uses to manage aquatic plants. So my request is that there are innovative techniques that are being used and tried. This notion of a general mechanical control permit should be given to lakeshore owners like us. We don't really like being singled out, but we want to get our lake cleaned up, and we certainly appreciate the challenges that Senator Dibble, you have with Loring and others, because this is a pervasive problem, but it's bigger than just the policies and practices of lake management today. And we're going to set an example.
So, Mr. Peters, is there a way you can suggest for, I mean, because of the differences in every situation and so on, and you don't want to have a general permitless removal, do you have any suggestions for these folks? I mean, I think what we may, is the DNR, I mean, I'll ask you, and I'm sure the answer is, oh, of course we're open, but is the DNR open to having such a meeting? Do you think you can come up with some solutions that might address some of the concerns? Because they're obviously out there.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, one of the solutions I suggested was development of a lake vegetation management plan, and that usually requires the people that live on a lake, they frequently are organized as lake associations. When we take that broader view of a lake and consider all the values that are there and the concerns they have maybe for access to the lake or other considerations concerning recreational use, the Lake Vegetation Management Plan offers a real opportunity to take that comprehensive look. We started using them in the mid-2000s, and it was really to start addressing the issues around curled leaf pondweed, Eurasian water milfoil, and other invasive species. But in the case of Shavers Lake Association and some others, we're using it to address some of the broader native plant issues as well and still maintain the values in a lake. We have staff that work routinely with lake associations in this regard, and we think it can be a fairly robust solution to many of the concerns that you have. Normally, when we issue aquatic plant management permits, it's usually on a lot-by-lot basis. And so we work with an individual lot owner and to make sure they can get a dock in, they can get to open water for fishing or swimming. But when you get a broader, more pervasive look at a water body, then we think the Lake Vegetation Management Plan offers a real vehicle. And it's available, and it's growing in use.
Senator Eaton and Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, my understanding is that this plan or this study is very expensive.
Mr. Chair, Senator Eaton, it's not. This is just developing a plan and highlighting how things can go. We charge for permits to do the individual control, but we do not charge for the plan in of itself. Permits do help support staff time in these things, but in our opinion, they're not expensive to develop or to provide that information to a lake association.
So like in the Loring Pond, which many people are familiar with that in Lake Benton, so Loring Pond doesn't have neighborhood association that, I mean, they're not property owners right on the lake, but I assume that, Senator Dibble, have they done something like this? Are they aware of that option, or do you know?
Mr. Chair, believe me, there's been a lot of meeting and a lot of conversation, this aquatic water management plan The first I've heard the DNR will just do this for free, because the last conversation I had, this was a several thousand dollar prospect to do another plan, by the way. They've already done one, and it resulted in this. And then they paid a ton of money to plant all kinds of great native aquatic plants, and then these invasive cattails started up, and then if you've been there, I mean, you'll know what I'm talking about. I mean, it's similar to the photos of Shavers Lake. You know, it's just the march of the cattails, and Loring Pond has two parts, a smaller part and then a larger part, you know, connected through a little waterway. And the smaller part is almost completely overrun now with cattails, and the larger part becoming increasingly so. It's fairly shallow, kind of landlocked water, and so it's ugly. And it's dangerous because, you know, people can lurk behind the tall weeds, and all the good work that the neighborhood has gone to is completely for naught. And it's not like our park board has a lot of money laying around. And a lot of this stuff, you know, happens through neighborhood initiative and neighborhood leadership anyways. And so it's very frustrating because the DNR simply refused to issue the permits.
Senator Scalzi, and then I'm going to make...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have been involved in a lake aquatic management plan in my city, and it took months, and it took many meetings with the neighbors. And granted, the DNR was there, and I'm wondering how is that being funded? Because it was a lot of time by the DNR and produced a document. And the problem is, as we saw it, I was in the House Finance Committee, Environment Finance Committee, and what we had a problem with there were so many costs with the DNR that we decided, well, now if people want to get a permit, they better pay for the cost that it takes to achieve that permit. So so a couple of years ago, we drastically increased the cost of the permits because we felt that it wasn't fair to all the taxpayers in the whole state to be doing that. But, you know, we have to remember that we have 12,000 lakes, and maybe this is not everyone is lucky enough to have a good lake association on their lake, and maybe this is part of a larger issue that we have to look at, but it's definitely something I think we have to look at, because to spend months in producing reports and involving people coming to meetings repeatedly is very time-consuming, and it costs money. So I think it's, you know, I don't want to hurt Senator Bonhoeff's steel, but I definitely think we have to take charge of this.
I will make one or two suggestions. I welcome other ones. One would be that we convene a meeting with several DNR folks and members of the committee who are interested in this, because I don't know we're going to come up with a real great, perfect solution now. I think that may be part of the reason it's been handled on a case-by-case basis this way. But maybe we can set something up. We could obviously offer an amendment to Senator Schmidt's bill to this evening, if so, but I doubt we're going to have a perfect answer before then. There may not be a perfect answer, but I guess I'm asking committee members, what's your will? What would you like to see? Is that reasonable? Would you like to do that? I think I've sensed, if there are others who haven't spoken about a local lake or something who like to be involved in it, let our committee staff know as well. Senator Dibble.
Well, Mr. Chair, I love the idea of adding something to Senator Schmidt's bill. So I intend to do that. Probably both this general language, and probably get something for Loring Park prepared by then.
I'm going to encourage you to meet with the DNR between now and this evening, and Senator Schmidt.
I was just going to say, Mr. Chair, I'm amenable to this addition. I think I would encourage that we use the 3 hours between this meeting and the next to maybe sit down and have a conversation and get some good language on
right.
that.
Right, I will.
Peterson, DNR, maybe Senator Dibble, since he's the one who wants to offer the amendment, might meet with the DNR between now and then. I very much appreciate if you can, because it may not be a fully resolved issue, but it would be helpful if at least there's an attempt to try and bring those together. Thank you, Senator Bonhoeff, for coming back after your bill. You did make it out of here alive. Senator Tomassoni, welcome to the committee.
Too funny.
And we are going to try and get this and the Scalzi bill done before we break for the
afternoon.
Hopefully
we don't have any more cattails.
Chairman, I'm spending a lot of time in front of your committee this year.
Mr. Chairman, I have a delete all amendment. Do you want me to describe the bill first, or do you want
sure,
to
it's being distributed right now. So while it's being distributed, why don't you describe what you're hoping to be accomplished?
Okay. Well, let me lay the groundwork for what the delete all amendment does, and then my witnesses can explain it to you. The legacy amendment opened up a lot of doors for citizens to our state, and the Park and Trail Fund is giving Greater Minnesota a chance to develop some of our most beautiful, abundant, and raw natural resources into destination locations where people come from the cities or the region or around the world, and they can come to enjoy it. You know, some of the examples of the places we're planning to develop include the Duluth Lake Walk, the Quarry Park in St. Cloud, or the Cuyuna Mountain Biking Trail, or the Mesabi Trail. And that's attracting worldwide following and changing the culture of a small town in north-central Minnesota, such as Crosby. So I know the Parks and Trails funding has been a contentious issue, and Greater Minnesota has been criticized for not having a plan and not having a structure for distributing the legacy funding. So members should know we are creating an excellent plan based on regional insights and defined criteria and protocol. The commission created in this bill becomes the structure for administering that plan. And I have Al Lifford here to testify, and he's the chairman of the Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trail Coalition. Mr. Larson can explain the amendment.
Mr. Lifford and Mr. Larson speak, Senator Coonan offers the A3 amendment with incorporating the change on line 33, deleting significance and inserting significant.
And Mr. Chairman, I think we need to. I think we forgot to put the appropriation language in that it comes out of the original bill, so I think Mr.
Knopf
knows how to do that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think the way to do this is, I think what Senator Tomasoni says he wanted this plus the appropriation to remain. So on the amendment, if you look on line 1.2, instead of delete everything after the enacting clause and insert, that should read page 1, delete section 1, and insert. And then on page 2 of the amendment, after line 2.21, there should be page 3, delete sections 2 and 4. And so then you would have this provision plus the appropriation from the original bill.
And so, Mr. Chairman, that would work. And then I believe that this is a peace in the valley amendment also. So I think some people
Senator, Mr. Knopf, can you repeat that? The
sure.
Line 2 would be delete section 1 and insert.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if you just delete everything before and on line 1.2 and insert page 1, comma, delete section 1. And then you've got your technical amendment 1.33, delete significance and insert significant. And then on page 2 of the amendment, after 2.21, insert page 3, delete sections 2 and 4. So then section 3 from the original bill will still remain in the bill. This would not be a delete everything, but a delete
Sections 2 and 4 and replace section 1. Right. Okay. Senator Coonan incorporates all of those technical changes into his delete everything amendment. Is there further discussion on the amendment to put the bill in the shape the author wishes? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. On the bill. Mr. Larson, Mr. Lefert, who's going first?
Let's go first.
Oh,
Mr. Chair, if you'd like me to describe what the amendment does.
Describe the bill, sure, as it is now. Okay, go ahead.
Sorry. Dan Larson, representing today the Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Coalition and the Minnesota Rural Counties Caucus. The bill establishes a commission, a structure, if you will, for the administration of Greater Minnesota Regional Park and Trail legacy funds. It'll consist of 13 members and 6 regional park and trail districts outside the 7-county metro area. Plans are developed organically within the districts and subject to public comment and review. To be considered regionally or statewide significant, the project must be natural resource based and meet the provisions of the Commission's strategic plan. Recommendations must be consistent with the Commission master plan, the Commission guidelines must be merit-based. It must consider geographic balance. It's allowed to hire staff and a director. Several other provisions shall meet elected members and chairs. It does the things commissions do. Elect membership and chairs. Commission shall meet at least twice a year, and appropriate funding. The funding, Mr. Chair and members, will be funding that comes from the Greater Minnesota portion of the legacy park and trail funds.
And Mr. Larson, that they would be allowed to take 2.5% of the money that's appropriated to the Greater Minnesota Parks?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct. Each year.
Mr. Liefert, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Marty and commission members. My name is Al Liffert, and I work for the county government out in Douglas. Alexandria is the county seat out there. But I'm serving as the 2013 chair of the Greater Minnesota Regional Park and Trail Coalition, and I'm happy to come down and talk to you today about this bill. This bill is supported by our group primarily because it addresses two areas of concern that have been prominent in the first years of legacy funding. If this bill is enacted, it'll answer the question of who do you talk to when you need to find out information about regional parks in Minnesota, particularly those in the cities and counties that lie outside the metropolitan area. This commission will address one of the primary deliverables in what has been called the 175 study that was authorized by the 2011 legislature, and that is to develop evaluation protocol and criteria to determine priorities for park and trail acquisition and development, particularly in those areas outside the metropolitan area. Working with this commission, the proposed bill would establish a group of people around the state who are fully aware of the 25-year park and trail legacy plan and its goals. They're fully informed of the regional park classification criterion that is detailed in the Minnesota Regional Park and Trail Strategic Plan. They would be able to recognize the regional differences across Minnesota and be able to respond to them in a structured manner and enable us to make good decisions on legacy spending going forward in coordination with the four pillars that have been talked about so many times: connecting people to the outdoors, acquiring and developing lands, and creating opportunities with partners. Committee members, there's 2.5 million people living in communities outside the metropolitan area, and regional parks serve these citizens the same way that regional parks in the metropolitan area do. They create near-home outdoor recreation opportunities. None of the Greater Minnesota Regional Park agencies has had the benefit or the requirement to work through a unified statewide organization previous to legacy, but we believe that going forward that it would be in the best interest of Minnesota to create such an organization. That's what this bill does. Our goal is to focus on selecting projects that produce the best outcomes for Minnesota and that align clearly with the 25-year legacy plan. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Knopf, you had a...
Mr. Chair, after Mr. Liefert was talking, I was looking on line 1.35, and right now it just says provisions of the legacy plan. I think it might be better to be very clear to use the same language that he was using, and before legacy, insert 25-year hyphen with 25-year park and trail before the word legacy on 1.35 to make it abundantly clear what plan we're talking about.
Senator Coonan moves that amendment to the bill. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I believe we have an A1 amendment that's prepared, and it hasn't been distributed yet, and I would like to offer it and then withdraw it, but I want to get it in the public record and talk about it for the future stops that this bill is making. I understand the bill is going to go next to state and local government and then back to finance. And in the A1 amendment, which if we could get those passed out.
It's being distributed, so why don't you speak to it?
Okay, I'll talk about it. It would provide a structure, and as you look in the amendment that we adopted for Senator Tomassoni, it is related to that subdivision 4, which is on lines 1.32 to 1.36. And in the amendment that you're going to be looking at, subdivision 4 is greatly expanded, and subdivision 4 actually, in the A1 amendment that we're going to talk about, makes the Rural Regional Parks Council more similar to what the Metro Parks and Trails Council, Open Space, is required to do. So in subdivision 4, if you have the amendment on lines...
We have it. So Senator Scalzi moves the A1 amendment. Go ahead, Senator Scalzi.
Thank you. Line 6 is the key here. Subdivision 4 on page 3, line 6. We're talking about regional or statewide significance. And this would provide an objective definition. The keys are the Natural Resource Board based, and 30% of the visitors have to come from outside the jurisdiction, and 20,000 visits a year and 100 acres. And the reason this is being presented is because that's what we have to follow in the Metro Regional Parks and Trails. We don't have a choice. That's in state law. So, I just want to offer it to discuss it, and then I will withdraw it. But I just don't think it's far enough. We do have to establish a comprehensive plan for Greater Minnesota, like we have in the metro area. And if there's 20% of the park legacy money going there for $8 million a year, we've got to really be careful, and we've got to be fair across the state regarding this. The metro park system, metro regional park system, has existed for 40 years. It has an established plan and criteria for the parks. And I think if we're going to – we keep losing money for the metro regional parks, and I think if we're going to share this money like this, I think we have to have established criteria. So it's for discussion purposes, and it's going to go to state and local. I think that I also sit on Senator Tomassoni's committee, so we'll be seeing it there as well after it goes to state and local. I serve on that too, so I'm going to see it another two times. So I'll be bird-dogging this and walking it through. And if there's any questions, we do have a member here, a representative from the Metro Regional Parks Board, if there's any questions from members of the committee.
Is there any discussion on Senator Scalzi's A1 amendment? Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. The subdivision 4 kind of gets to the question I was going to ask about how we construe a regionally significant park and trail in greater Minnesota. Senator Tomassoni will probably recall my bringing up this issue in your committee when the subject came up when we were having the overview hearings. I guess my question is to Senator Tomassoni. This would appear to be peace in the valley, Senator Scalzi's. I think you're getting close. Calming me down with your bill proposal. This gets me even closer. I'm wondering if you have a response or a reaction.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, this is the first I've seen it, and I was of the understanding that the amendment that I have or the bill that I have in front of you now it was the Peace in the Valley amendment. So I'm happy to discuss this with Senator Scalzi as this moves forward, because I know we're going to be talking about this quite a bit more before this gets done here. So I don't really have a comment on it yet, but I know that Mr. Lifford would like to talk about it, and I would just kind of reserve my judgment for right now.
Thank you, Senator Tomassoni and committee members. And I would like to respond to the question from Senator Scalzi, and we recognize the methodology that's used in the Metropolitan Regional Park and Open Space Commission and the rules and the criterion that is used in that area of Minnesota to determine regionalism. We found in that those rules
are specifically designed for a large, densely populated urban center. And about 97% of Minnesota lies outside of that seven-county area. And although half the population lives out in that part of the state, those areas of densely populated urban centers are not, it's not the reality out there. So the criterion that's going to define regionalism within those other parts of Minnesota are going to be quite different than what is used in the metropolitan area. And we think that's appropriate, and we don't mean to gloss over that there shouldn't be any rules. And we referred to the strategic plan that is part of the 175 study, and within that strategic plan there is a very defined description of how a property is determined to be what its regionalism is. We would submit that that's the criterion that we would like to use going forward, and as other committees get to look at this and get to look at those criterion that are laid out in the strategic plan, that hopefully it will make sense.
And Mr. Chair, I do understand that I understand that we've come a long way with this. I think it's got a ways to go yet. I think the bill needs more work, and I would certainly like to work with Senator Tomassoni as we move it forward. I'll see it two more times. I applaud the effort, but I just think that we can improve on it because we don't want to make just a little local park become now the regional park if nobody goes to it from outside the area. That's what limits what we do in the metro area. I have one regional park in eight cities. So there's lots of small local parks that don't have access to legacy funds. And I think that's what we have to concentrate on, is that we do make it truly regional so that if we're taxing people all over the state, it's not going to one little local park that somebody may lobby to put in the plan. So because we can't do that in the metro area, and it has served us well. We've worked through quite a number of years against trying people. I mean, I just can't put one of my local parks in the metro regional park system because I'm prevented by this law, by this regional or statewide significance. And I just think that to use statewide tax dollars for which people voted to tax themselves, we have to be very careful that they're used regionally and not locally.
Senator Marty, Senator Scalzi, we are completely in agreement with that concept, and I can tell you that when we held our regional meetings around Minnesota, we faced severe questioning from people who wanted to do exactly that. They thought that Legacy was going to repair their tennis courts. We made it clear that we recognize that Legacy projects are supposed to be different than that. These are for big projects. These are for projects that can't be funded any other way, and we completely agree with that.
Senator Dibble, Senator Benson, did you have something?
I did have a comment, if I could, Mr.
Go
Chair.
Ahead.
To Senator Scalzi and Senator Tomassoni, I find myself in a very odd situation. Anoka County is celebrating 50 years of regional parks. But I also grew up in a very small town that has parks of regional draw and influence that aren't 100 acres, but that have a set-aside wetland near them that could have the feeling of a much larger park but might not meet the criteria. They are regionally very important, but they probably don't get 100 or get 20,000 visitors in a one-year period, but 30% of their users do reside outside the area, and so I'm glad to hear that we're working towards something that lets places of regional significance be measured by some criteria. But I just want to make it clear, even as someone who benefits from the Metro Parks districts, that this strict a criteria is not going to meet the needs of Greater Minnesota. There needs to be some adjustment to this. And so as a Metro legislator, I'd like to just be very clear that there needs to be criteria, but these are not the right size for Greater Minnesota.
Senator Scalzi, did you have more comments?
No, I just, at this point, I would withdraw the amendment. It's for discussion purposes, and I'll work with Senator Tomassoni and with Senator Benson if you'd like as well.
think you've had a good discussion of it, and as you point out, you're on all three of the committees the bill is going to. Thomasonian, you are going to have plenty of discussion.
And Mr. Chair, I'm on Senator Thomasoni's division as well, so I will appreciate Senator Thomasoni's efforts. I would be curious to know what the existing you alluded to the guidance document, the planning document. I can't remember which one you were citing. What are those criteria that you want to adhere to? I mean, what are the standards or the sizes?
I think that I could quote those. There's a section three of the study deals with four sections of criterion that have to do with is the place a regional destination? Does it represent a unique outdoor asset that draws people from a wide area? And there are several different levels of there's three different levels of choice within that. But thinking on my feet is not really my best point here, and I would really prefer to just say, let's look at Section 3 and show it to you, and then I think that's the best way to answer that question.
Great. All right. Well, Mr. Chair, given that metro regional parks have to adhere to fairly specific criteria and standards set forth in statute before they can access legacy dollars, and we know where the heartburn comes on this whole, you know, construing a new thing, regional parks in greater Minnesota, comes from. This is a welcome conversation, and I would just advocate for Senator Scalzi's approach that we get pretty specific so that we can avoid some of the unpleasantness of the last couple years and months.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Dibble, I appreciate that comment. And as Senator Benson said, and as Mr. Lifford said, the situation in rural Minnesota is a little bit different it's quite a bit different than it is in the metro area. And so while there could be and maybe should be some criteria, I'm not sure that exactly the same criteria for metro should be applied to the rural. So we should figure out a way to make it work, but it doesn't necessarily have to be the same language.
I'll make one final comment because I'm not on either of the other committees that this is going to, but I'm not sure if 20,000 visitors in some parts of the state would be huge. I think Senator Benson hit the point about the one-third from outside of the jurisdiction is important, but then the other part is the funding, because some of the metro parks have hundreds of thousands, I mean, some of them million visitors a year kind of thing, and the funding, they're more area, but there's a lot of people in the metro area, and some of the metro parks I know are stressed, but I'm not on that committee. I just wanted to comment on that before that. And I had one more question about the bill since Senator Scalzi's withdrawn her amendment. I had seen someone from the U of M had put together an incredible overlay map showing where various trails and so on. And is that being used by this group, or was this ordered by, who proposed that? I mean, the university did some incredible mapping stuff of where trails could be and how various types of trails interact with other regional parks and resources and so on.
Senator Marty and committee, the university's inventory and framework that you're referring to, the second deliverable in the 175 study was to create an inventory of regional parks and trails. We began with baseline information that was the university's database. That database was constructed in such a way that it was not updatable, so we converted that into an updatable database that park professionals around the state can interact with in their office and continue to provide more detail to that. Because while the university's database was really well constructed, there just wasn't very much information in it. They didn't get very many responses, and so we recognize that this needs to be something that people who want to participate in legacy funding need to be required to fill in this inventory. We have to know what's out there before we can determine whether there's enough of it out there.
Thank you. With that, is there further discussion on Senate file 1021 as amended? If not, Senator Coonan moves that Senate file 1021 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on State and Local Government. Is there further discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Senator Scalzi, the last bill for the, we hope to finish this one.
Okay, get up.
Senator Scalzi, Senate File 613, Public Finance Authority.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This Senate File number 613 is for the PFA, Public Facilities Authority, who is a multi-agency financing authority that helps finance infrastructure programs for mainly smaller communities, but larger communities as well, that don't have the resources to replace failing stormwater and wastewater systems. And they assist local governments to understand the financing process, the funding process, program requirements, and local responsibilities. PFA, as most of you know, has the authority to sell tax-exempt bonds. So today here we have with us Jeff Freeman, Executive Director of the Public Facilities Authority.
Mr. Freeman, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you. The bill before you, and we do have a handout in your packet with our little PFA logo at the top. This bill focuses, most of the financing we provide is through our revolving fund loan programs. However, this bill focuses on the grant programs that we have to supplement the loans, and specifically or primarily this bill focuses on streamlining and simplifying the programs that we have that are funded from the Clean Water Legacy Funds. The Total Maximum Daily Load Grant Program was created several years ago to provide additional assistance, 50% grant assistance, when a city is required through a total maximum daily load study that's focusing on a specific impaired water, when the city is required to provide an additional level of treatment over and above what they would otherwise have to do, that program provides some assistance for those costs. There was also created a phosphorus reduction program, basically the same idea. When a city is required to provide additional phosphorus treatment above and beyond what they would otherwise have to do, there's a 50% grant. What we'd like to do, there's a lot of overlap between those two programs. We'd like to merge those into one program to simplify the process for everyone. And then take that one step further and say that any time a city is required to provide additional levels of treatment over and above basic secondary treatment, they can access these funds to help build that project. This will help speed up the whole process. Cities won't have to wait for the TMDL grant or the TMDL study to be approved by EPA. If the permit limit has been set and the city's ready to do the project, we want them to be able to access these funds and get that project going. And that's sections 1, 2, and 3 of the bill focuses on that. Also, the revisor instructions and repealer then gets rid of the phosphorus program as a separate program. And because the name now kind of needs to be changed, we're proposing point source implementation grants as a new name for that program. Sections 4, 5, and 6 of the bill refer to the small community wastewater treatment program. This program addresses very small unsewered communities, generally 20 to 30 households or less. Oftentimes these communities have straight pipe raw sewage discharges, very serious public health problems, but very small communities with limited capacity. This program has two components. There's a technical assistance grant and then construction loan and grant funds. And we'd like to raise the cap for the TA grants and the construction funding to better address the kinds of cluster mound systems and things that come through this program. Finally, Section 7 of the bill addresses a situation with our wastewater infrastructure funding program WIF grants, as they've been known. This program supplements for high priority projects when the costs of that project are high, typically for a smaller community, that to the point where they can't afford it with just our revolving loan funds. These grants have been available. It started as a grant program in the mid-90s. In 2005, it changed to a deferred loan program as we were trying to adjust some issues related to the term of the total term of the loan that we can provide. In 2011, it changed back to a grant program because we were able to better fix that issue with our revolving loan fund. So we ended up with 16 communities that received these deferred loans kind of in that window of time. What we'd like to do kind of as a fairness issue, take the current criteria that are used to determine grants, apply it back to those communities, and to the extent they would qualify, we would convert those deferred loans to grants at this point. So there's no new outlay of funds. We've already funded the project and built the project. It's just converting that deferred loan to grant.
Questions from Mr. Freeman? Is there any discussion on the bill? Anybody who wish to speak with concerns about the bill? This bill is going to Finance Committee, I believe. If there's no further discussion, Senator Scalzi moves Senate File 613 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
I'm told the DFL may be having a caucus that may go till a few minutes after 6 o'clock, so I think I'm going to suggest we meet, is it in this room? This room at 6:30, so people aren't just hanging around waiting. 6:30 this evening, and we have both of Senator Schmidt's two bills, and I will be presenting the omnibus energy bill at that time. No action on that, however. We're just going to be going through it section by section and so on, and then having I'm going to try and meet with stakeholders in the next few days, and we'll be acting on it on Thursday, and if we need be Thursday night or Friday. With that, this meeting is in recess till 6:30.